Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you movies and the histories behind them. And this week, I have a simple question for you. What happens when you combine Geoffrey Chaucer and David Bowie and the hottest cast in Hollywood? Maybe you get the best medieval film ever made. It's time to sit back and relax and get ready to get rocked because A Knight's Tale is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. How are you, my medieval friends? Are we medieval?
We're medieval.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, Thomas is a recovering medievalist.
Not anymore. Recovering medievalist.
I met you at Kalamazoo. That defines you as medieval.
Yes, and I have both many fond memories of that and also many fuzzy memories of Kalamazoo. Yes.
Oh my gosh, I met you at Kalamazoo should totally be a Hallmark Christmas movie.
If only people loved medievalists enough.
Where Saturday Night is a dance with your bibliography.
I've never been to the dance,
and I will admit I need to go back to Kalamazoo at least one time to actually stay for the dance.
There's a dance at a thing.
Yeah. I saw my undergrad favorite professor dancing, double fisting beers. It was surreal.
Wow, that's the first time double fisting has showed up on our podcast. So that's we haven't even
you've been doing the wrong kind of movies.
I guess so. Like,
see, we're off to a good start already.
Hi, Anna, and welcome to the
podcast. All of the comments that come to mind are so inappropriate that I couldn't say them. This is fine. Everything's fine.
This is fine. It's okay. We're all trained scholars. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves in the drink that you're having right now? John, why don't we start with you since you're the first person to arrive?
Fantastic. My name is John Wyatt Greenlee. This is, I think, the fourth or fifth or tenth time I've been on this podcast. I am a medievalist by training. I work with maps and cartographic history. I am also the world's premier number one eel historian. So right now I'm drinking bourbon, drinking larceny, and I am thrilled to be here. Me and my drink thrilled to be here.
Where does that bourbon come from, John Wyatt?
Oh, probably anywhere but Kentucky. Kentucky's terrible.
Are you doing that shit? When I got here to Colorado, people were like, "We make bourbon here too." I'm like, "You don't kiss your cousins here. Y'all don't make bourbon."
No. This is from Kentucky. I have a bourbon upstairs that's from Utah, but it's not as good.
You have a little bit of bourbon from me. That's terrible.
Oh my God! Yeah. No. That's wow. Yeah. No.
I wound up with my hands on a bottle of Prohibition bourbon. It's terrible.
It is.
Sounds special in a number of ways.
All right, so that's me. I do maps and eels and drink bourbon.
I don't even know how we put that on the CV, but let's do it. Thomas, introduce yourself, sir.
I'm Thomas Lecoq. Also been here a couple of times. I'm an associate professor of history at Grandview University in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm still on campus, so I'm drinking water. But when I get home, there will be Akintoshin, and it will be glorious. I am trained as a medievalist. I'm an early Americanist recovering now. I'm an early Americanist now, and it feels pretty delightful. I
still feel like Americanists. Like we talk about medieval. We can get into this stuff, but it's, don't we have a medieval period in the North America? I don't know.
I mean, so like, how this works? Do you really want to go down that rabbit hole, Jason? Because we
not before we introduce that. Anna, because Anna's here for the first time, and I'm like, we're not going to get sidetracked.
But yeah, I've seen this talk on Twitter about medieval America.
It's beautiful. You know what, Anna? That was very
my
nice.
My God, cocktails come from the heavens when she speaks.
Cocktails are delivered from the heavens.
My God, this is going to be either the greatest or worst pod we've ever done.
Greatest.
Everyone hold up your watery libation while we're doing this here. I'm taking a picture. All right, there we go. Anna, introduce yourself. It's your first time on the pod.
I am also a trained medievalist, working on a dissertation about Chaucer, among others, Chaucer and his buddies, let's go with that, and how they deal with the concept of old age. I used to run a website on what we had good reason to believe was a rape charge brought against Chaucer. And now, very recently, very excitingly, we found new documents, and it looks most likely it was actually a labor issue. Complicated.
Oh, okay. It's like this shit got dark fast.
Oh, it was whiplash. You have never seen document discoveries so hyped.
Mm. Oh my God, yes.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Well, what has been hyped, my friends, is this pod. We have been working on this pod. This pod has come up, and I think every single pod, Thomas and JW have been on the pod. We've been building to this single one forever. And it's time. It's time for us to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Shall we rock the audience? Is it time to get going? Are we talking about a nice tale?
Yeah.
Let's start. Let's just dive in.
Do you have Queen in the background?
We can. I'm told by our intrepid producer Fletcher that if we talk about some of the music in depth, like Golden Years and We Will Rock You, then we can actually layer that into the pod. So sweet. At the behest of not getting sued, if we can bring those things up and talk about why they matter. In fact, we have to talk about the music. It's maybe the single most contentious aspect of this film. And it's also why it turned in me – that and Labyrinth turned me into a David Bowie fan. But we'll get
– Jason.
Why Golden Years and why not Magic Bands?
We're going to do is Labyrinth. You know that, right? Now that you've said the words, we're going to do a Labyrinth pod now.
Is Labyrinth medieval? Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Labyrinth, it is. Labyrinth can be whatever you want it to be. Labyrinth is glorious.
I used to play Magic Dance.
But it's more like folk tales.
I'm in. I don't care. Yeah. I love it. Like I love all things Labyrinth. I grew up with it. Jennifer Connelly. I'm going to need a minute. It's just, it's a perfect film. Just like A Knight's Tale. All right, let's just jump in. Okay, first question. Is A Knight's Tale the best movie ever made in the history of mankind? Go.
No.
What?
I'm sorry, but no. It's very close, but have you not seen The Princess Bride?
Okay.
Hot take.
It is not. Hot take. I can't say it's the best movie ever made in the history of time. It is, Liars. In my opinion, the best movie ever made about the Middle Ages, with Lion and Winter being the other one it's in contention with.
Is that Richard Harris?
Yeah. Now, is it my favorite? God, no. Knight's Tale, favorite medieval movie, second, 13th Warrior, third, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
But like,
best. I think this is also best movie. Knight's Tale is the best movie made about the Middle Ages, in addition to my favorite.
All right. John W.?
That's pretty much where I would land, too. That I don't know that it's necessarily the best movie of all time ever, although it could be. But yeah, it is by far the best sort of medieval film out there.
Yeah. And that's kind of amazing. Like, there's so much about this film that is completely anachronistic. It joyfully plays with the history. It joyfully plays with all of these somewhat real characters like Chaucer. It's based on some other dudes. It's based on some stuff. And
it's an interesting movie in that it really pisses off a lot of people. Who get hung up on the anachronistic qualities of it. And they're like, but it's not medieval. And it is most medievalist's favorite medieval movie by a mile. Like, there's not a whole lot of debate about that. It just is. Because it captures the spirit of it. And like, even the sort of anachronistic qualities of it are point to some of the like the unintentional anachronisms in movies that try to be really much more sort of nitty-gritty and detail-oriented, which is great. I really love that.
Bear with me for a brief tangent on the anachronisms. So I've been doing some stuff on the side teaching high schoolers and middle schoolers Latin and whatnot, and they look online for translations and they find these things that were translated in the late 1800s. And it makes the poetry utterly alien to them. Mm-hmm. Or even I'll look in like the Norton Anthology and find a modernization of Gawain and the Green Knight. And yet Norton has to put a gloss on the side for some of the words because they're a little archaic. And we do that to try to convey the sense that like, this is old. You know, those Victorian translations are using language older than Victorian English to drive that home. But when these people are writing, they're not always trying to be formal. Not everything from the past is stiff and serious. And it would work much better if we actually translated things into our current language. And so that's what A Knight's Tale does fabulously, with the music and the costuming and turning it into, well, a sports movie. That one character wears, like, high fashion that's really clearly not everyone's taste and frivolous. That we bring in David Bowie. That dance scene is one of the best scenes ever, because it makes you understand that medieval parties were, in fact, parties. They had fun.
But you can't have fun in the medieval period. It's all dark and terrible. And
also, the movie has color.
Yes. Yeah. The color's important.
Well, and part of it, this is the last pre-9/11 medieval movie. This comes out, what, summer 2001?
Yep.
Right before we decided that everything needed to have a muted color palette and every peasant had to be literally encrusted with shit on screen.
Well, I mean, that's been a thing that we've seen over and over again. It's like everything, that color palette, that washed out blue thing that drove me nuts about The Norseman, right? That Robert Eggers film. It's just so goddamn hard to watch because the colors are shit. Why does it have to look that way? It's like we were predisposed to this idea that the Middle Ages were blue-gray, and that's what we've got.
Or covered in mud.
Both.
Yeah.
Both end. Yes, covered in blue-gray mud, or, you know.
I will say that, like, Knight's Tale doesn't entirely depart from that either, right? Like, there's not a middle class in this movie. There are rich people and there are poor people, and the poor people are poor, you can tell, A, by the clothes, and B, by the fact that they are always sort of dirt-stained. Like, it is a marker that the movie is using to tell you class and station, but that's really different thing than, like...
Hey, some of the knights get covered in mud, too, when they face plant.
That is true.
They do.
But they clean up. They clean up later.
Yeah.
Well, and the setting that they live in is not drab, right? Their clothing may be drab. It's a marker of the economics of the color, but they do not live in a world that is devoid of color and music and life and joy and basic human things. I think Brian Helgeland's comment on the music was like, he figured the 70s were always the 70s. So 1370s, 1970s, let's go for it. I mean, like, I love the fact that he's just owning that the point is you want this to feel normal. You don't have full string orchestras until the early modern period. You're making anachronisms there too. We censor stuff weirdly. I'm sure you guys, like, you've read, like, William the Ninth's troubadour poems, right? Right. Jason,
that must be a question for John W.
This is not for you, Jason. Sorry.
Not so much.
Not for you. I'm like,
I write about cows in Florida. Like, I find it to be very moving. So yes.
medieval love poetry, like, is sometimes deeply romantic, but, like, the guy who is credited as being the first troubadour has entire poems about fucking his vassals' wives. Very explicitly, right? Like, you'd be playing Petey Pablo. Well, that'd be Catullus. Catullus would be Gene Pablo Freak League in the background. But, like, yeah. But, like, I love just making it feel alive, right?
Well, Catullus, unless he's translated by the Victorians.
Yes, in which case it is, you just have giant redacted for Catullus 16. Jason, if you ever want to read some filthy Roman poetry, just as a gift to yourself, Catullus 16, the title has been called, I think it's been called, what, the filthiest expression ever written in Latin?
You know, it's funny. I was actually on filthyromanpoetryhub.com earlier today. So
I'm sure that exists. I'm happy for you.
It does.
It's about to. We're talking about an NEH grant application being filed tomorrow.
So can I ask, Jason?
Yes.
In the questions you sent us, you mentioned having to read Chaucer in high school. And the way you mentioned this suggested that it was not an enthralling experience.
Bit of a chore, was it?
Fun in this movie.
I want to, and I'm so happy you're here, because
you have to read?
I don't remember. Like, high school was, first of all, like 30-something years ago for me.
He's my age, Anna.
The fuck does that mean, John? So I'm 46. So I would have been reading Chaucer in sophomore, junior year of high school, right? In Kentucky, which, mm-hmm. you know, if for people who are not familiar, the interesting thing about being a historian is actually going to Kentucky is actually like going back in time anyway. So, you know, I had the two things going on. I hated it. But again, I was a really poor high school student. And the resources we had at Callaway County High School, not the best. And I'm almost convinced, Anna, that probably what we had going on in the 1990s were really poor translations of this material. It's almost like reading the King James Version of the work, you know?
But the other half is that Chaucer writes in all sorts of genres. And so there's some stuff of his that's like sermons that I would frankly rather do my taxes and yours instead of reading it again. And I like Chaucer. But I think I can safely say you didn't read The Miller's Tale.
I think that I did.
No, I can't imagine you read The Miller's Tale in
high school. I would remember it, I think.
You did not read The Miller's Tale in high school.
Are we allowed to swear?
Yes.
I literally just asked John what the F, like when he said we're the same age. No, you can, kidding me? Absolutely, you can swear. Swear, by all means. If you're a prude, this is not your podcast.
In The Miller's Tale, there is a fuckboy with a guitar. He won't stop playing the guitar outside the window of the woman he's got a crush on, and also her husband's window. There is a series of shenanigans in which someone kisses someone else's, unclear whether it's, well, look, I got in trouble at one point for translating a word, I would say accurately, to cunt. For high schoolers, or butthole, and then he comes back and makes out with someone else's rear end, they fart, and he rams a hot poker up there.
See, you'd remember. It's not
a delicate story.
I kind of feel like that got left on the editing room.
He is, however, kind of hilarious. Chaucer writes pretty much every genre there is at the time, so he's got some poems that are just petty little things. And I do mean petty, like, hey, my scribe, why do you keep screwing up what I'm dictating to you? You suck. He's got stuff like, I'm in love with her and she won't even look my way. I'm going to die of love. He's got these epics. He's got things that read to me with a bit of a horror vibe. Things that are more like modern fairy tales. Everything. And also, yeah, the dirty stuff.
And I think part of, to your point, Anna, a minute ago about like sort of Jason's early experience, and I think a lot of people's early experience with Chaucer and Shakespeare and a lot of other things is they get sort of written in as sort of canonical pieces of early English literature. And so they are approached, what, sort of slightly religiously, right?
Literature with a capital L.
Yes, exactly. And that's how they get presented. And of course, among that does a couple of things if you give a high school student that. And one of them is it's going to turn them off on it, right? Like, this is how you teach middle school students and high school students that Shakespeare is boring and Chaucer is boring, is you treat it like, you know, you treat it like scripture.
Plus, yeah, if you don't translate it, mm-hmm. if you tell them it's English and they'll be fine.
Yeah.
You yep. should feel bad.
Yep.
Well, actually, okay, so while we're on Chaucer, we'll come back to setting the stage a little bit later, but we're on Chaucer now. I want to talk about it. Anna, can we talk about Paul Bettany as Chaucer? First, like, what are your thoughts on Paul Bettany's Chaucer? This is a verse. When I started watching this movie the very first time, I didn't even put together that it was Chaucer, right? It was like, it's just some random, what, like, because I was so far removed. I didn't understand. This is Geoffrey fucking Chaucer, right? So, just in case those of you still listening.
The father of English literature.
Yes.
That's not Shakespeare, that's Chaucer.
What are your thoughts what are your thoughts on Paul Bettany's Chaucer? Do you like this version of Chaucer on film? Yeah. And do we see other versions of Chaucer anywhere else?
I cannot think of a single other version on film.
Really?
We do have some, we have a sort of manuscript portrait of him done by someone who probably knew him. There are a series of books written by a medievalist. Oh my gosh. I'm blanking on who. Murder Mysteries, I think, that have Chaucer as a side character. Bruce Holsinger. Bruce Holsinger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. But I can't think of him on film, although I'm not a huge film buff.
I can't either. Maybe everybody looked at Bettany's character and was like, nah, I can't beat that. We're done.
He's nude. When does Chaucer live? When is his time? Is he along in, or is this film set with, Tom, you said 1370. Is that about right?
Earlier than that.
Are you sure?
No, apparently it's set in 1372, although it's got a few things that don't always line up.
Right. So the Battle of Poitiers is 1356.
Mm-hmm.
Which it like the time, so you're basically talking mid 14th century. Like the timelines, the specific timelines for the movies don't line up because Chaucer's born in 1340 or so. So like at the time of Poitiers, he's like 16 or something.
It does line up. So in the 1370s, he was traveling a lot in Europe, sort of on errands for the king.
Right, but what I'm saying is like Rufus Sewell's character gets taken away from the tournament he's gone for a while because he has to go fight. And there's that scene at Poitiers where he's looking at the tournament results. So like that puts a real firm like timeline marker if you care about it in 1356.
Some interview they said 1372 because I was trying to figure out.
Well, so that's when what the Book of the Duchess gets written in 1370 or so.
Later.
Anyway, I think you've got sort of mid 14th century, and you've got kind of a lot of things that are happening all at about that same time that the film is sort of squishing together and not really caring about the timeline, which makes sense with the movie. So, but yeah, somewhere between 1350 and 1370, somewhere in that range.
See, that actually, as an outsider, for someone who doesn't know medieval history, that actually tells me this film's even more historically accurate than I thought, because I had always thought that they were just kind of taking some just assumptions, like this is a generic country, these are some generic battles, this Battle of Poitiers.
No, there's actually quite a lot of very real history undergirding this movie and making it work.
All right, well, go for that, guys. Let's jump in on like the real history of this film, about what you can like, what we can actually see, things that actually took place, and then we'll jump into some of the stuff about the music and the clothes and Shanna Sossaman and Heath Ledger. We're gonna do this whole thing on Heath Ledger's brilliance, but let's talk about the actual history that we actually see on film. What are we actually seeing here, John? You're talking about the stuff undergirding, which is, by the way, a really fancy word. What are we seeing on screen here? Aside from Anna's cat.
The Pope is French, which puts this before 1376.
Mm-hmm. Jesus is English.
As is pointed out, Jesus is English.
One of the great lines in the film.
That's until he becomes American later on.
Ulrich von Lichtenstein's real identity. He's a 13th century.
Oh, is he?
He's a 13th century Minnesinger. He's a German troubadour, effectively. Everyone should just be a troubadour because Southern France is the greatest. He's mid-13th, 1220s, 1230s? Is that his high point?
I think that's right.
He writes a book, it's like, Service to a Lady or something like that, that is all about like how you properly act as a knight with your courtly love shit, which is great. Like, it's great having Heath Ledger's character adopting this identity. I think that's cute. Gelderland is a real place,
I mean,
but different.
I credit him with inventing chivalry and courtly love.
Do we give him credit for that? Yeah.
Sometimes, I think.
He's right. He's certainly writing right in that time period. We should probably come back to the question of sort of chivalry and courtly love, because it's important in a whole bunch of ways. So, so the movie is set in sort of in the middle of the Hundred Years' War, essentially right at like the sort of the apogee of England's success in the war. At the point where England is sort of its absolute most successful. So the Battle of Poitiers, which happens in the middle of the film, is a crashing defeat for the French, where the French king gets captured and taken back to England and held essentially ransom in London for several years until he signs a treaty that basically gives the English all of France. So like you're right at the moment where like it doesn't get any better. The Hundred Years' War never gets any better for the English than it is right now. And sort of the English hero of this moment is the Black Prince, Prince Edward, who we see several times in the film, and to a lesser extent, his father, Edward III. But the Black Prince wins several major battles, including Poitiers, and then winds up dying of dysentery about 10 years after this film. So he never actually, like, he gets to live on in English sort of folklore and history as like a paragon of virtue, without having to actually like rule and stuff. So you've got the Hundred Years' Wars going on. You have a lot of contestation between the French we tend to think of it as like a war between France and England, but it's really a war between the French king and the English king. And it's really complicated and convoluted about who's on what sides, because they all have, many of the lords in France and England have allegiances to both kings, and they're having to choose. And you get a sense of sort of what we might think of as early nationalism that comes out of this, but it's a real mistake to think about it in like real nationalist terms. The first part of this movie set in France, which is sort of the seat of chivalry and these tournaments. There are, in fact, a lot of these tournaments. There is a tournament season that like thousands of knights from all around Europe come to France. By the time you get to the 14th century where we are here, it's a real thing. Like there are people that come for a season, thousands of them, and they have these tournaments. And the tournaments are initially bigger sort of melee fights, and the jousting that we see is sort of an aside, but by the time you get to the period of this film, jousting is actually the primary thing that you see at tournaments. So that's kind of real. A lot of the sort of pageantry and the procession we see in the film is real as well. There is not a world championship of jousting as sort of fun as that would have been, but like yes, there were cash prizes, and there were like smaller local tournaments and big tournaments, and they tended, nobles had and kings had held tournaments and jousts to celebrate anniversaries and crownings and all kinds of things. Like, so it was a real thing, and it starts the tournaments, they start as sort of an attempt, especially in France, I think, to sort of rein in some of the violence, the sort of random violence, acts of violence you get going on with the knights and things. And then by the time you get to this period, it is much more stylized, which we kind of see, right? I think the rules about, like, you know, 1 point for a hit here and 2 points for a hit there, that's made up. But like there's a lot of what we see about jousting in the film that's historically accurate. Other things that matter, the Rufus Sewell's character, which is great. I love his character in this movie, but, he's one of he introduces himself as the leader of the free companies, which is a thing in the Hundred Years' War. There's not one free company. There's a whole bunch of them. Basically it's bands of mercenaries, that get hired by the French king and the English king to sort of fight, in the Hundred Years' War. And they, in periods of peace, which you have in the middle of this movie, they become a real problem, especially in southern France. So these are all things that, like, there's a lot of actual history sort of undergirding the plot of this movie, and in a lot of ways moving it forward. So it is, for as much sort of fun as it has with the history, it is also a very serious sort of, it's floating on a very serious lake of history.
I want to ask you guys, you know, a very major part of this film is the idea of a man changing his stars, right? This idea of a person going from peasantry all the way into nobility. For those of us unfamiliar with this era and the class system of the age, is that possible? Can people go from peasantry? Talk to us. You guys like, no.
Historians are shaking their heads. I can see that, but I want to make a few points about Chaucer himself.
Oh, go.
He's from a merchant's family. His father was a vintner. Pretty much the relatives that we know before that were vintners. They were pretty well-off merchants, but they were merchants. He winds up marrying a lady-in-waiting to the queen. Her sister winds up marrying John of Gaunt, one of the princes, a brother of the Black Prince. Chaucer winds up in the king's household eventually after he's first served in the household of a daughter-in-law of the king and then two of his sons. Chaucer's son Chaucer actually winds up a member of Parliament for a bit. His son is chief butler to four kings. He's Speaker of the House of Commons. And if we go just a few more generations down, his son has a daughter, Alice. Alice's grandson is Richard III's heir before Richard III gets his butt kicked and then gets buried under what's now a parking lot. So, like, Chaucer's granddaughter's grandson doesn't wind up on the throne, but that's because a battle went the wrong way.
There is social mobility, and the like, and it's not, I mean, Chaucer's a great example of it. You see this in, like, you see this in France as well, where the building of a bureaucratic state, you start bringing people from outside of traditional noble families to help run the bureaucracy so that they have to owe allegiance to the king instead of other loyalties. They're like, Anna, you're, again, I mean, yes, 100% correct in every possible way. You don't become a knight, though. Not in your own lifetime. You do not rise from peasant to knight. Generationally, yes. And just on levels of wealth and influence and power, you can make meteoric climbs. I think I'm trying to remember if I'm correct in this. I think Helgeland had the idea while reading a biography of William Marshall, who is already a knight and goes from being a relatively poor knight because of, I mean, the end of the anarchy, to being like, I mean, William the Marshal. So like the meteoric rise at that point, but it's the two, squishing the two things together. What if a peasant becomes a knight? Isn't going to happen, but a poor knight can become super important, and a poor person who is clever and has the right connections can now become very important in his own, in their own life, but like pass on better fortunes to their children.
So I'd add to that, like at the sort of bottom end of nobility and knighthood, there is, it's not like a firm line. Like there are people that sort of fall out of being knights and fall back into sort of lower classes, into sort of what we might think of as middle class or even peasantry, right? Because one of the things you see in this film, right, is like if you're jousting with somebody and you beat them, you get to take their horse and their armor, and that shit's expensive. Like if you beat a poor ass knight and you take his stuff, he's probably not going to be able to like repurchase it, which means he's sort of out of the game. And so there are places where people in what we would think of as the knighthood sort of fall out, and where people sort of at the upper ends of what we might think of as the middle class sort of move up. There is mobility. And I think we talked about this when we did Kingdom of Heaven, right? This idea that like it is conceivable for a blacksmith to have gone from being a blacksmith to a knight, or a knight from being a knight to being an advisor to the king of Jerusalem. But to go from blacksmith to advisor to the king of Jerusalem is like a step way too far. So like there is mobility, and sometimes in, as Anna said, over the course of generations, there's can be sort of extreme mobility. But like in one lifetime, it tends to be a little more confined than that. It is also the case that if you impersonate a knight and you get, or a king, this happens sometimes too, and you get caught, you're kind of screwed. Like nobody's going to be like, that was funny. Cool. We're just going to live with that. Edward the First who has an impersonator? There's several English kings who have an impersonator, but I think there's Edward the First maybe who has an impersonator who he brings to the castle to talk to, brings to London to talk to him, because he thinks he's really hilarious. And then the guy starts yelling at him for sitting on his throne, and Edward's like, nope. And hangs him and his cat. I think is
because
apparently the guy under torture confesses that the cat made him do it. So I think it's Edward the First, but I might be wrong. It's one of the Edwards who has this. Yeah. So like there are people who impersonate kings and lords, and you can get away with this actually in places where like nobody has seen the king for a while because you just have to dress like him. There's medieval sumptuary laws that like limit what different classes can wear. So like if you want people to think you're noble, you just have to dress the part essentially and be in a place where nobody knows who the noble actually is. It's like that part's actually like reasonable that he could have pretended to have been a noble dressed in knightly clothes and passed it off and then gotten in trouble for it.
I want to ask you guys about love. A major part of this film is obviously the love story between Heath Ledger and Shannon Sossaman's Jocelyn. And I have two questions. One, did nobles ever marry out of romantic love? And then two, was it possible to marry or to love beyond classes? I know that was a big thing, you know, in earlier in the 80s, the idea of Prince Charles and Lady Diana was that these cross class kind of things. So what about, and that seems to be a thing here too. Like Heath Ledger's pretending to be a nobleman, but he's not, and everyone knows he's not. And yet she accepts him even once she finds, and we'll get into the quotes that Thomas is like dying to talk about here in a bit. Talk to me about love. How do feelings work in the Middle Ages?
How much do you trust what they write?
Uh-huh. Ooh, are we going to complicate the archive?
Look, you brought me in because I'm a Chaucerian, and the number one thing about Chaucer is we don't trust a thing he says.
I brought you in because Thomas and John said you were fucking cool. So
we were right.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, go on.
So I can tell you about what the literature says about love. Their literature.
Go for it.
But that doesn't mean that that's what they actually did or felt. So in a lot of the literature that's about courtly love, as we'd call it now, marriage isn't really simpatico with being in love. And I was trying to find it before this and I couldn't, but I know that there is one tale that ends with, and then they lived happily ever after, as if they weren't married. love, people. So marriage is an impediment to love. There's guides to love. One of them, I think it's Capilanus, says, well, if someone's left a widow, can she, if she's in love with, like, one of her servants, marry him? No. Nope, can't marry below like that, but he can be her lover. Just not her husband. So this is all sort of suggesting that there's not a lot of love in marriages, except that Book of the Duchess thing that Chaucer actually mentions having written. We're pretty sure it was commissioned by his patron John of Gaunt after John of Gaunt lost his wife Blanche. The Book of the Duchess is about a character called the Black Knight grieving his lost Lady White. The grief is, like, sometimes called overdone. Like, it is seriously hardcore, you know, the light of my life is gone and I am not getting over it. And this isn't necessarily proof that John of Gaunt was really Otrulio in love with Blanche, but it's suggestive.
The guy I wrote my dissertation on, Raymond de Saint-Gilles, is excommunicated twice for not leaving his first wife, and he just shrugs it off and seems to stay with her until she dies, even though by that point he has changed his fortune so well that the next person he gets married to is the daughter of Roger of Sicily, and then after that, the daughter of the King of Spain, and he stays with his wife until he dies, because I'm pretty sure that, you know, there's nothing in the archives to say one way or another, but, like, what if he actually likes her? What if, and hear me out, people in the Middle Ages are human, right? Now, that's not always great, because, like, if you ask, like, what is the greatest love story from the Middle Ages? The most kind of, like, gross, I mean, I'm French, like, what is the most, like, gross French love story of the Middle Ages? Oh, you guys have never been to Paris and done, it's Abelard and Heloise.
Sure.
It's the worst. It's the worst. It is the grossest and the worst. Right? Because it's she's his teacher, and then it goes horribly awry for him. So, like, there are examples that seem to be love matches that, like, are only cute if you ignore literally everything about how they meet.
He's his teacher. I just want to make sure the audience knows. No, other way, he's her teacher.
He's her teacher. Does he get castrated by her uncle?
Yes.
Yeah. They and some friends. They break in into his room. And,
I mean, I gotta be honest, hashtag team, you know, Heloise's dad in this one.
They have a kid and named him Astrolabe, which is kind of like naming your kid computer.
Yep.
Is this where Elon gets it?
Heloise is then sent to a nunnery to keep them apart. Yes. Right? And then they write letters for the rest of their lives.
So we're still in love, right? And he's like, my sister in Christ. And she's like, yeah, but with romance?
Yeah, she seems to say, doesn't she then have his body brought to the nunnery when he dies?
Don't remember.
Not sure.
I think that's what ends up happening. But it's like, there are also, like, really problematic love stories that get championed from the Middle Ages. There's a ton of bad love poetry. There's even some good love poetry. I really like Geoffrey Rudet's L'Encombre les Jours si l'Encombre, during May when the days are long, where it's all about, I have heard of this beautiful lady across the sea, and I will never, never shall I enjoy love unless I enjoy this faraway love. Like, it is, sometimes it's like high school boy cringe level, you know, love poetry. I think it's real. I think it's cute.
Worth pointing out, actually, a bit of a digression, but two of Chaucer's besties, William Neville and John Fanvaux, who got involved when he was in a court case, both knights, both went on crusade, died on crusade, one very shortly after the other, buried together in a tomb where their helmets are like practically kissing, and the way things are arranged with their heraldry and such is the way it would have been done were they married. So is that projecting into the past a bit? Quite possibly, but it seems like there were some real relationships, although that one's not obviously officially marriage.
It's a difficult thing to get at. We don't have a lot of material really explicitly talking about the way that people really felt. We have a lot of sort of upper class versions of love. Like, so one of the things that happens with this sort of courtly love that we're talking about is in the, like, the 12th century, it's a literary trope, right? It's a thing that people are writing about, the sort of this knightly, courtly love, which is not actually about marriage and it's not actually about love. It's more about like being in love with somebody that you can't actually be with and then going off and protect, like fighting for her, protecting her virtue while she pines away for you somewhere else. And this is not in the, like, the 13th century. It's not really a reflection of what's going on. By the time you get into like the 14th and 15th century, people in the upper class are reading these and being like, oh, that's what love is. Okay. So like
it becomes, you should be getting physically sick until she returns your love.
Yep. So it becomes a thing, but that's really does not give us a particularly good glimpse at what's actually going on in most people's lives, not even most nobles' lives. And we have the same thing with children. I was thinking this about this earlier, Thomas, when you're talking about how like medieval people are people. Like in a lot of the 20th century history of Europe, there's this idea that like medieval people didn't love their kids. They just didn't, because they didn't write about them. And like, that's entirely inconsistent with like people.
The single hardest thing I have ever read was a chronicle that someone was updating each year. And then it got to the year that the second wave of the Black Death hit his town. Mm. And that second wave was, we think, particularly hard on children and young adults. And it goes from this impersonal, you know, these phenomena happened, this king, whatever, to, and then I lost all my children. And it's heartbreaking. Like, the odds of reaching adulthood were not what they are now, but that didn't make them any less caring.
No. And so when you ask about questions about like sort of human emotion and feelings and love in the medieval period, it's super difficult to get a hold of because you're dealing with stylized tropes a lot of the time that are talking about something that's maybe partially real, becomes real, isn't real. It's super hard to say.
How much of like your approaches to dating in especially high school were influenced by what you saw in movies and read in books? Mm-hmm. Right? We get these scripts and we don't follow them exactly, but they're guidelines.
How much do we actually write about love now in the kinds of sources that will survive 1,000 years?
Oh, we don't write anything now on the source that'll survive 1,000 years.
Okay, first of all,
years.
Nothing from this time period will survive. It will be just like GeoCities. It'll be great.
I disagree. Have none of you listened to Taylor Swift? That stuff's going to last forever. Okay, 1989. It's beautiful. And if you don't like it, that's too bad.
The medium is surviving and being legible. Whereas Twilight, I hate to say it, has so many physical copies.
Yeah, but it's garbage paperback.
But the paper's not going
to
last.
So it's if you want it to survive, you're going to go carve it into a stone somewhere, or you're going to write it in leather and go bury it in the outskirts of Phoenix, Arizona.
Right? That'd
so
work.
So that when the sands claim it and they dig it up, you know, 200 years from now, they'll, right? So like, I often think about this in the way that we want to talk about like how people felt about their children and how people felt about romantic love and how people felt about their spouses. The people who do the writing, most of the writing that survives in an institutional format, are members of the church who, if they have children, should shut the fuck up about it.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. I am in love with this woman. No, you are not. Scratch her name off of this list. Never speak of this again. We will drive you from the monastic gates. There is just an institutional holding apparatus that is not going to be the people who are going to tell you about how people felt about, you know, their children and love affairs.
And mostly it's men writing and not women on top of that.
Mostly it's men writing and not women. Most of the documents for the laity for quite a while are legal documents, right? You're not writing a journal of how you feel about stuff. You are writing like a book of deeds that proclaim that, like, actually, no, I'm a big enough noble that you have to respect my land holdings. It's sources.
There is the Romance of the Rose, which is all about how you're supposed to do courtship and whatnot, and is dreadfully misogynist. And then we have Christine de Pizan, who's like, you bastard. Let me tell you how women actually feel about this stuff. But for the most part, we don't have that perspective.
So I tend to think that, again, people in the Middle Ages are people, right? And if we don't have the sources for how they talk about these topics, again, we don't have healthy sources about this now. Right, like the shit that like people sell is like the pickup artists who are like selling ads on X, being like, "Come, I'll teach you how to neg women into dating you," whatever the fuck that means. Like, that's
okay.
That's
I actually read that book.
Jesus,
I read that book.
Are you?
How did it work out for you, man?
Patton's terms, like Rommel, you bastard! I read your book. It's just.
I read that book, the book about the negging book, in like 2000 and I don't know, 4. I had frosted tips. I was living in West Palm Beach.
You were the audience for that book. That's beautiful.
Mm. Well, you know, that book was geared to awkward young men, right? Who want to speak romance to other women and don't know how. So I read the book, and the thing I will tell you about the book
still
is
don't know how.
I'm in a relationship, sir. Many years later, no longer the tips are no longer frosted, and the hair is gone. But it was a lovely written book. The book itself was Neil Strauss was the guy who wrote the book. He could write. Now, I'm not saying that the words we should follow are good. Like, as though one should not evoke Hemingway as a modus operandi, but one can appreciate the wordsmithing. He was a Chaucer of his day, Neil Strauss, actually. Can you imagine Chaucer writing about negging in the 1300s? That's what I want to see. And I want to know how Chaucer negs.
Yes, actually, something that Chaucer comes to again and again is seduction, consent, coercion, and all the shades of gray in between those.
So I'm telling you guys, 600 years from now, someone's going to pick up that book, The Art of Seduction, or whatever it was. We're going to have to put this in the show notes, the Neil Strauss book about negging. Right.
Look, if they really want that, they can go to Ovid, Ars Amatoria.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then his follow-up, which is like, okay, girls, here's how not to get taken in by the strategies I just put out there in part one. And then, since this is all clearly setting up a disaster, the third part, which is how to make yourself fall out of love.
I have an answer for that, Anna. It is called Papas Pilar. Not yet a sponsor for the Historians of the Movies podcast, but
could be
if we want. Actually, and if you look here, there's a word. Success. Ernest Hemingway right here. So
Look at that segue. Well done, sir.
Isn't it nice? I try. I'm getting smooth with this. Smooth like dark cane, sugar molasses rum throughout the Caribbean.
I do love the fact that the letter is all that poetic verse stuff, though. Let's bring it back to the movie, because I have nothing to drink, guys. I have a bottle of water in my office.
Oh, yeah. And that's where we're at now.
There is no one to blame for that but you, sir. I did want to, well, to pull back towards the movie, I did want to say, like, we were talking about, like, people being people, right? And, like, humans being human now or then. And that's one of the things that I think all of us really love about this movie is, like, the sort of talking to my kids about it, because they watch it with me, and it's like it's my favorite medieval movie because it's not accurate in a lot of ways, although more than it looks, but like it captures the vibe of it, and it gets to the idea that like these were people living, breathing, enjoying life, like going to parties, and everything's colorful, and like the vivaciousness of the movie is one of its best features, I think.
They all have depth to them, even the side characters, Jocelyn's maidservant. I don't know, like they all are given amusement at things, frustration, and that actually feels like a wonderful tribute to Chaucer, because he excels at creating these realistic characters. But yeah, they're people. You know these people.
Do we get the sense, Anna, that this movie is kind of being written by Chaucer later on?
Oh boy. Yes. So, can I tell you about The Knight's Tale, not Knight's Tale?
Oh, yes, please.
Chaucer writes his Canterbury Tales, which is what he's known for now, although at the time, other stuff. He says he totally himself went on a pilgrimage with all these other folks, and he's going to describe them for you. And let me get back at some point to his descriptions of the partner and the summoner. They are not flattering, as promised. But one of his characters is a knight who's depicted as a kind of good guy, and the knight gets to tell his tale first. And it's a very traditional tale. And in it, Theseus, our classical Theseus character, has just conquered the Amazons and has married their queen Hippolyta. And her sister Emily is hanging out with them all. Theseus has also done some more conquering and has two prisoners of war. Palamon and Arcite are cousins, are besties, and then from their prison they spot Emily and fall dramatically in love, even though they're not sure at first if she's actually human or a goddess. And they immediately become worsties instead of besties, because which of them should get Emily, who at this point does not know that they exist. And as an Amazon, probably wouldn't care that they exist. Shenanigans happen. They both wind up escaped from prison or out of prison. Being young men in love, they make bad decisions. Chaucer's characters often make bad decisions and get in a fight where Theseus finds them and is like, "You're not supposed to be here. Oh, you're in love with my sister-in-law. Tell you what. You get to assemble teams. We're going to have a big tournament. And whoever wins gets to marry Emily." And beforehand, they all make their prayers. And Arcite prays to Mars, the god of war. "Can I please win this tournament?" Palamon prays to Venus, the goddess of love. "I want Emily." Emily prays to Diana, the virgin goddess of the hunt. Neither?
Yeah.
Like, not with the marriage thing, but if I have to, give me the one who loves me best. Tournament happens. No one dies. It's a whole fun day for everyone. Arcite wins. But before marrying Emily, he gets, I think, bitten by a snake or something, or thrown from his horse, and he dies. And on his deathbed is like, "Palamon, bro, I want you to marry her." So everyone gets their prayer, except kind of Emily, who gets literally screwed. And we can see some of this is in A Knight's Tale with the two dudes who are battling it out over Jocelyn, who's initially kind of like sick of the whole thing. Now, the dudes are not besties at any point, right? There's a lot of adaptation going on, but it's a pretty clear source. The other clear source is Lancelot, the Knight of the Cart, where to prove his love for Guinevere, he is told he has to lose tournaments until she changes her mind and says, "Okay, win." So a lot of this is just lifted straight from medieval texts. But sorry, that's the quick and dirty spark notes.
Yeah, I remember watching this thinking every single time that I saw it, when she does the flip-flop on the, "You have to lose, then you have to win." You're just like, you...
Totally medieval. Right?
Oh, totally.
Okay, but what? I'm sorry. We're gonna have to put in the quote there when he gets the information, when his arm is his shoulders being like undislocated, and he says that what is it? It's something like, "I love her," blah blah blah. But like, "And for that, I say my rosary to Jocelyn alone."
Yes.
And Watt's like, "William, that's blasphemy," and then turns it really hard. Is just a great moment.
But then he gets in the tournament again, having been told to win, and is like,
There's your love. There she is, the embodiment of love. Yes, and oh, how I hate her. Oh, it's so good.
God, this film does not have any right having such clever writing, because it is so. And we're gonna get to the writing. Do we want to do the writing or do we want to do the music first? Which one do you want to go with? We talk music? All right, let's talk about the music. I want to introduce a new segment to the Historians of the Movies podcast called My Friend Craig Bruce Smith is Wrong. And...
Okay.
I say this because
what was Craig wrong about this time?
Great many things. And I say this because Craig, if he's listening, knows that I absolutely dearly love Craig. He's actually the very first time we ever did a pod. It was with Craig. Many times the HATM came out of a conversation that I had with him and Robert Greene about Predator. So I hope if Craig is out there listening, he is anger ball right now, because Craig has a problem with the music, with the anachronism of the music.
So he's just straight up wrong.
Because he's straight up wrong. And that's why we're calling this.
Yeah.
My friend, Craig Bruce Smith, is wrong.
He is. I'm sure he's a lovely person.
He's not, but he's my friend. So let's talk very tiny arms. They're coated in like sleeves and everything. So Craig, if you know him, is 6 foot 19 inches tall and is a fan of George Washington and bad movie takes. So, let's talk about the anachronism. Let's talk about the brilliance of this soundtrack and what song really does it for you. The floor is yours, guys.
The opening is perfect in every goddamn way. No notes, 10 out of 10. And people who don't like that should just not watch this movie. They don't deserve it.
And what really sells it, and it is, I think, not just the queen, which is great for the scene, but the fact that they're into it. They are singing it. Like, it's not music that's happening over the top, like, that only the audience gets to know. Like, it's the entire scene, right? Like, and that's great. That tells you, like, right off the bat, like, that this is a movie about people, like, enjoying life and, like, being into the moment. And I think, like, Anna was talking about earlier about sort of the translation of it, right? Like, yes, they would not have been listening to Queen, but they might well have been singing something else. And, like, that wouldn't make any sense to us, but Queen makes sense to us because, like, that's a stadium song, goddammit. We know what it means.
I have had We Will Rock You stuck in my head all day. Mm-hmm. Just because
there are worse songs. Yeah.
There are absolutely worse songs. And of Queen, that's maybe my least favorite song, actually, but.
But it works really well in that moment.
Which means, like, it's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's socially evocative in some very specific ways that matter for the scene.
We know that feeling of cheering for a team.
Well, and like, I don't, maybe I'm wrong and maybe you guys know better than me, but like, I don't know that we actually have a great sense of what secular music genuinely sounds like, right? We might have notation, we might have surviving instruments, but like for secular music, like non-vocal music, I don't know that we have great scores before like what, 15th century? Surviving, like, we might have some ideas about like what instruments they could play, but like whatever you're about to do with them is a modern notion of the music anyway. So why have some bullshit pretense that you're doing it accurately when you could just go for it and feel joy?
Well, I'm willing to bet that amateur bagpipers now and amateur bagpipers then
sounded just as awful.
Okay. Like, fair enough.
Ducks and thunderstorms, but yeah. Yeah, it's one of those places where we pretend to an accuracy that we're nowhere near.
We want to do a medievalism, right? And we want to do the medievalism that feels like the right medievalism, right? It's we're going to do an orchestra. Cool. Those instruments didn't exist and wouldn't have sounded like that.
Do you guys have a favorite song from this film? Is there a moment? Is it We Will Rock You? You've got Queen, AC/DC, Bowie.
My favorite scene, maybe not song, but scene, really is that dance because of how it makes visible what the movie is doing. That shift from a stylized dance that could plausibly be medieval. It is so alien to us. I have no idea if it is or not, but alien to us looks slow and boring into a dance party. And that transition, I think, helps to explain the rest.
It's the joy of that scene, right? It's the fact that, like, again, if the emphasis is to make the Middle Ages feel real, to make them feel lived and the people who lived in them to feel normal, that scene is so perfect for that in every way.
That's why this film succeeds so much. It humanizes the medieval era.
And again, like there's a moment there where Heath Ledger is mouthing the words, right? Like the again, the music is like part
this
of this
is what you do when you dance.
It's part of the scene. It's not just sort of overlay for the audience.
If you guys never seen me sing Billie Jean, I mean, come on. Like, we dance at the Southern Historical Association too, you know? So,
And I'll add in, like, I poked around with the costuming and saw someone had criticized especially Jocelyn's dress in that scene, because that shade of chartreuse is not good on anyone. But you look at all her fashion, and that's not the point. She's just being stylish, which is often not about the male gaze. So her dancing in that scene, the costuming in that scene is true to how we do things now.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
We're going to get into Ledger here in a few moments. I want to save a section for Ledger, but I want to talk about quotes. Thomas and I have been like texting each other romantic lines all week.
We do that anyway. This time it's not just us to each other.
To be fair, it's a lot better. You know, it's a lot better than when we did the 13th Warrior, when Thomas and I are talking about geese all week. So, God, that translation line every single time. We got to talk about that in the terms of, like, when we do a pod of best scenes in film history, someone's going to look at us and go, 13th Warrior, really? And we're going to go, yeah, that scene. Yeah. It's perfect. Oh, my mother
was a pure woman. And at least I know who my father was.
My father is. You pig-eating son of a whore. God, I love that movie. Oh, can we do... I can't wait till we go back to do the 13th Warrior the second time. Oh, we're doing it every year. All right. I think I'm lying. All right, so... favorite quotes from this film. Because this film, we've been dropping these quotes all day. But this film's got some real great zingers in it. And some really... beautiful lines in it. Go for it, guys. Your favorite quotes.
There's a whole bunch of them. I'm going to start with one that probably doesn't mean anything to anybody else, but it does to me, which is...
Is it like geese?
No, it's about eels.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, it fucking is.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, it damn sure. All right, so this is right at the very beginning of the movie, after William wins his first tournament, they split up the money, and all three of them are talking about like what they're going to do with their money, right? And Roland says, this is enough money for me to go back to England. And Watt starts daydreaming about food because that's what he does. And the first thing he says, the first bit of food that he daydreams about is eel pies. I'm going to go to a tavern and I'm going to get eel pie. And I love that because, I wrote an entire dissertation about why eels are an intrinsic part of like early English identity. So like the fact that you've got this English guy in France finally gets his money. He's like, oh my God, finally I can go eat eels. Just really made me happy. It is not one of the most memorable lines in the movie, but it stood out to me. Maybe my favorite line in the entire movie is Chaucer's intro line, right? Like, where he trudge. Walks past, yes, he walks past them naked, and they're like, sir, what are you doing? It's like, trudging, you know, to trudge.
Can you hit me with the whole line? Because it's so good.
Oh, boy, I don't think I can remember it exactly. The slow, determined walk of a man who has... nothing else to live for. Nothing else to lose.
Not that it's a gambling problem that we know of, but.
Right. On the other hand, trudging does suggest resolve and resolve. Yeah, the entire scene is great. Good. I mean, Bettany's character, we talked about this, but Bettany's character is fantastic. But that opening line just gets me every time.
According to Chaucer, what happens then is as you are matriculating up to the historical ranks and you go to defend your dissertation and you walk into the room, you are not walking so much as trudging because you have nothing left to lose at that point. You're 10 years in, you're, let's go. I want to talk about eels or cows.
You have to get through the snake fight portion of your dissertation defense first, but it's fine.
one of the great memes of academic history is that. All right, Thomas. Tell me something romantic.
I mean, okay. Again. So listen, for somebody who spends as much time being a troll on Twitter, I'm a giant fucking softy of a human being. So I've got three. They are my three favorite lines in this, because again, I am a giant softy. Your name makes no matter to me so long as I can call you my own. Fuck, man. That is...
You are not doing the Before Midnight trilogy with me, is all I can say. You'll cry the whole time.
Whole time. It'll just be me weeping and drinking in the corner.
You and Ethan Hawke. Go on.
Yeah. And then the next two are in the same section when they're all telling him to run. To know you, William, would take a lifetime, one I am most willing to give, followed by, yes, William, with the pigs.
With the pigs.
With the pigs, the poor can marry for love. Here's the thing. All anyone really wants is for somebody to choose them in spite of all of the obstacles in the way. That's all they want. To be known, to be loved, to be chosen in spite of it all. Dear God, this movie is lovely.
All right, Anna.
Okay, this is going to be a weird one, but when the Black Prince goes, but personal historians discovered that he's of an ancient royal line, because that is just such authentically medieval bullshit. I think it's the Abbey of Petersburgh that at one point it chronicles like, oh, and then we totally, in the walls, found this charter that says we definitely got given these specific lands. Trust us.
Yeah, watching that scene, my 9-year-old was like, oh, so he's descended from a king? I'm like, no. No, he's not at all.
He definitely is now.
But it is beyond contestation at that point. So I would add that maybe one of my favorite parts of this movie isn't in the theatrical release. And Thomas and I were talking about this earlier today. But so it's from that scene at the stocks, right, where his men come out to defend him, right? And so Roland stands by him as he should, and so does the Ferris, and Watt wants to fight everybody. And then Chaucer comes out, and what we see in the theatrical version is Chaucer sort of tries to fight everybody too, and then the Black Prince intervenes. But there is a scene there that was not in the theatrical edition that is Chaucer giving a speech that quiets the crowd down. And it is maybe the best speech in the entire movie. It's fantastic. Like, he stops trying to fight and starts doing the thing he's good at, which is talking. Like, so, like, somebody throws some food at him, and he sort of touches it and licks his mouth and says, mother, is my mother here? I'd recognize that too. I'd recognize that cooking anywhere, right? And everybody kind of laughs a little bit and starts listening to him. And then he sort of gives a speech about William and his heart and it sets, among other things, it sets up the Black Prince's like sort of intervention a little bit better. But that scene I really like, and I had forgotten that it wasn't in the theatrical release, and so that's which is what I was watching last night or the other day, and I was really disappointed because it wasn't there. So that's really good. Aside from the bits that we've all noted, the movie has just a ton of like fantastic one-liners. We'll make your entrails into your extrails.
JW, you're talking about the Black Knight, and there's a great line because there's this real idea that he and William kind of see into each other. You know, there's a real respect between Edward and William. And there's this great line when they first meet where he says, you know, you didn't yield. And he goes, it's not in me to withdraw. And Edward says, nor in me, but it happens sometimes. And William's like, it does, right? And I'm like, I was watching it last night going, God, that line hits me. These are two guys that get me. And it's also like, boy, there's a parallel. You know, there is a real part of like who we are just as people that sums us up. Like, I want to fight. I want to go through. And it's not likely to quit. But even I have, you know, sometimes, boy, that one just kind of cut through me as I was watching it last night. It really made a lot of sense to me. And then the other one, of course, Jocelyn, the run and I will run with you. And this goes along with Thomas. I mean, but there are just.
Must so everything much. Be on a man's schedule?
Oh. And the funny one, maybe the thing I think about, the quote I think about most in this film is, it's called Halant, hello. I mean, that's.
Yes, given the timing of when the film came out and thinking about it as a historical artifact of like, being the last medieval film pre 9/11, better a silly girl with a flower than a silly boy with a lamp, with a stick.
Yeah.
That one hits really differently when you put it into some kind of bigger context.
What is a flower without its petals? And yeah.
Yeah.
We need to talk about another historical aspect here. And I want to get now into Ledger. And I'm going to introduce with you guys a couple different things here. Because Ledger, we all know, it gets taken from us far too young. I have argued in the past, will continue to do so, that I think he was the best actor of his generation. I think that if he were still with us, he would be dominating screens right now. Maybe not even on the big budget kind of stuff, but the small stuff that, like, the man's scale was really only even beginning to become apparent. If you look at his sketch, if you look at his filmography, I don't know that another actor erupts on the scene, maybe unless we're talking about Tom Cruise. And I want to give you some, I want to give you some years in films, okay? 1999, 10 Things I Hate About You. 2000.
Yes, your adaptation, hands down.
2000, The Patriot. 2001, A Knight's Tale. And this film is really the one where they start to sell Ledger as the leading man, along with Monsters Ball, smaller film, right? An actor's film, right? 2002, The Four Feathers. 2003, Ned Kelly. 2003, The Order sees him reunited with Shannon Sossaman. 2005, we get Brokeback, The Brothers Grimm, Casanova, Lords of Dogtown. 2008, the Dark Knight. We get 10 years in the sun with Heath Ledger. You know, has there ever been an actor with a stronger entrance into Hollywood, into our collective consciousness, than what Ledger had? He had the entry with the really the entry into, like you're saying, Anna, with the perfect Shakespearean film, teen film, right? A lot of people, I'm Gen X, a lot of millennials, so Gen X will consider Breakfast Club to be the best high school film ever made. Many millennials consider to be 10 Things I Hate About You to be the best high school film ever made. Every generation has its own version. It's kind of the perfect intro to him. We get the supporting role with Patriot, and then we get this. What do we think about Heath Ledger's, like, emergence on the screen?
I think I'm leaving this to the other two because I am not a movie buff. I mean, he's cute, but I can't really differentiate great acting from mediocre.
I see this film, and I see this film specifically as the emergence of a super megastar. And there are two scenes in particular. One is commonly a gif. It's him sitting on horseback looking at Jocelyn, and it's the wink. And then, as we've talked about earlier, Anna especially, the dance scene. I feel like when we watch him dance to Golden Years, and he does like this, he starts to open it up, and when he does this hop in the middle of this dance, you see the emergence of a next-level actor and superstar. I feel like we see Heath Ledger go from actor to superstar in this film. What do you guys think?
I mean, yes, right? Though saying that he's not already there after 10 Things I Hate About You is hard for me because I love that film so much. I actually think, like, the meteoric stardom is less interesting than, I mean, my preparation was not reading up on jousting. Mine was reading trivia about this movie.
Sure, go for it.
And they filmed this in the Czech Republic, and people thought they were going to have a lot of prep work to do. And so the cast came really, really early and then actually didn't have anything to do. They, like, learned some of the sword fights in the first couple of days, and they just had a couple of weeks of just all of them hanging out together in Prague. And what everyone seems to remember about this is how charismatic Ledger was, how kind he was, how he became the leader of a group of people who are all older than him, how he took care of Alan Tudyk after, like, one of Alan Tudyk's friends died of a drug overdose. And, like, Heath Ledger, like, tracked him down to the bar that he was drowning his sorrows and just, like, took care of him for a couple of days. That, like, people came out of this movie not only like, yes, Heath Ledger is going to be a star, but Heath Ledger is one of the good people in film. And there's something about it that he comes across as incredibly charismatic and funny and wild and super energetic, but also, like, you believe that all of these people like him enough that they'd stand in front of the stockades with him. And the reason that works is that they've just spent a month actually spending every day together, all day, a group of friends hang out before they start filming, and they all actually like the man.
Oh, the chemistry in this film, even with Rufus Sewell.
Yeah.
Like, you get a sense that, like, and I love Rufus Sewell as an actor. Like, I wish I saw him more as a hero kind of a character.
He wishes he would too. Yes.
Yeah.
He said that repeatedly.
Because I really, really like Rufus Sewell. I think he's phenomenal. You get a sense that these people really like each other. The chemistry in this film is so much fun. Mark Addy, you know.
Yes.
Shannon Sossaman. And the chemistry between Heath Ledger and Shannon Sossaman is... Chaucerian? I don't know. I don't know if there's good canon. I'm totally taking a guess, Anna. It's like,
that's romances.
It's good. It's really good. So here's my question. I hate to do this. If Ledger survives, and I wish he did, and you could cast him in anything, who would you have cast? Who is your dream person you would have cast Ledger as? Do you have somebody?
You know, you asked this question in the email you sent out, and I gave it a lot of thought, and I didn't come up with anything. And I think because he's an awfully malleable actor. He's really good and so good that I had trouble sort of pigeonholing him into a movie. Like
the disparity between this and the Joker.
Mm-hmm. So I gave that question a lot of thought, and I couldn't actually come up with he would be great as X, because I think he'd be great at just about anything.
You know, he wins the Oscar for Joker. And deservedly so. That you're, and I remember when they were making the film, people were saying, "Oh my God, you guys!" You know, there was all this stuff like, "Oh, they cast Joker." I remember there was at the time, how could they cast Ledger? People, we didn't appreciate Ledger at the time for what he was going to be. And there was all this talk about, "Oh, Joker," and then he comes out and does this performance. But I got to tell you, his performance in Brokeback Mountain as Enos, I think, is one of the most beautiful, heartbreaking roles I've ever seen. It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen as far as a romance goes. That deeply introspective role that I have a hard time picking up many actors who do better job in a single role than he is in Brokeback. I just losing Ledger hurts. Because I was telling this Thomas the other day. I was walking around the other day thinking, God, I'm angry sometimes that we lost this gift to artistry. This guy who could encapsulate so much of the human condition, you know, is phenomenal. I don't know where else to take this part of the conversation, but acknowledging it maybe is enough. I don't know.
I think the real joy of Heath Ledger is not just that he would have been good in any role, and so you could cast him in whatever comes to mind. It's the fact that he made such interesting choices. Right. You have a couple roles that are like you're clearly pushing him into your like these let's do pretty boy war movie blockbusters. And then he's gonna be like, well, that was fun. Let's go back to doing stuff I really want. I am no longer going to do like brooding teenager. What if I'm a gay cowboy? Right. And what if we really like commit to this role? And then like, oh, wait, you think I'm too pretty? What if I'm the Joker? Right. Oh, that's too serious. And you're like heading into the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which like, I'm sorry, it's a Terry Gilliam movie. You were going in a whole different genre of like what on earth this could be. I would have loved to have seen where he went with that. What would he have chosen to do next if he had had, you know, another 10 years? Or would he have gotten to the point that he'd done everything he wanted to do and he'd find something else to do with his life? Whatever choice he made, it would have been interesting to see where he went, because he could have gone anywhere he wanted to.
Is there anything you don't like about this movie?
I have to have a DVD to watch it right now because it's not available on any of the streaming services I subscribe to.
That's a whole other conversation about digital media.
I have a DVD. It's in my DVD player at my house. No, I'm covered on this. I love this movie.
It plays into the sort of nationalist idea about like the Black Prince is this sort of paragon of virtue, and he gets cast against Rufus Sewell's character, who is clearly the villain, and like, you know, like the, and there's this interesting scene where Sewell shows up back in London, and they're like, oh, he came back because the Black Prince like told him he had to disband his army in southern France because they were pillaging towns. But it's like, no, that's what the Black Prince was doing.
reason why he's the Black Prince.
After he won Poitiers, the English paid off all of their mercenaries and brought them back home, or most of them, and the French didn't. So like, you do have free companies wandering around southern France, pillaging and burning towns and things, but a lot of them are not the English ones. Anyway, it makes for easy storytelling, but I don't like the fact that like those two characters are so uncomplicated in terms of like they're good and they're bad. So there's, you know, so that I don't like. That's a pretty minor quibble though. Mostly I really just like this movie.
Anna, what do you think?
I don't love how binary the class system looks. We've talked a bit about that earlier, but there is a middle class. There are people who are in professions, are making money, have their own sorts of influence, and they just seem absent entirely, other than maybe our blacksmith?
The blacksmith and the partner and the summoner.
I wish we talked about the blacksmith more. I love her. I love Kate.
I kind of wonder with her like Nike swoosh, which apparently they had to get permission after the fact. And I wonder if that swoosh that's for a female Greek goddess of victory for a female blacksmith is maybe a subtle reference to the whole like Amazon thing in The Knight's Tale, but that's a stretch, I realize. That's a big stretch. The partner and summoner, I wish they had more depth, and this is incredibly nitpicky. Chaucer's depiction of his partner and summoner character, real unflattering.
Like, as he promised.
As he promised. Those are the two characters in Canterbury Tales that get read most often as queer. And that was definitely going on when this movie was written, was scripted, whatever. Given how much everyone else, or almost everyone else in the film, gets complex motivations and all of that, I wish they'd had a bit more.
That's a fair point. And they are kind of bit characters. I picked them out here because we were thinking about, like, where is the middle class? And, like, okay, well, these are people who aren't nobles and who aren't peasants and, like, clearly have money. But, like, there is an entire class of not sort of sleazy gambling mobsters, but, like, there's an entire class of, like, middle class of people who are in between the, like Anna said, in between what we see.
You can't think Chaucer in the sleazy gambling mobsters because he's kind of giving some of those vibes.
It's true. It's true.
You know, here's the amazing thing about this film. I was thinking, God, this is an awfully nimble film. We get in and out in an hour and 35, hour 40 minutes. And I just checked. It's 2 hours and 12 minutes long. And yet, this movie feels like it's about 27 minutes long. The pacing of this film is cranking. They really, really nail moving us along from point to point, to introducing everyone, and they do that extremely well and really quickly, moving us along, get us to point, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I didn't know this was almost 2.5 hours long.
I didn't either. I had that same reaction because I watched it with my kids, and we sat down to watch it on Sunday night, and I was like, oh, this is like an hour and a half movie. It'll be fine. And then we're like an hour and a half in, and it's the kids' bedtime. Like, wait, we still got 45 minutes to go here. And I was really...
Your youngest doesn't sit.
No, he doesn't. So I was really surprised by the length, and it doesn't feel it. It really doesn't.
All right. I want to ask you guys, Thomas, you're dying to say something.
No, I think part of it's just like the brightness and the light of the film, right? We have gotten so used to like movies that are just dark and gloomy and
they drag your
soul out of you. There's a color palette designed to make you think you are in a Norse hell. This is, it's bright and it's fun and it's lively and it's energetic.
Fun.
And it carries you along.
I have to ask, how much of Barbie's recent popularity is because it actually had colors and you could understand what the hell they were saying? Like,
but also,
sorry,
like, why early MCU is like so great? Yeah. I don't know that they're actually that great of movies, but they make such a palate cleanse. Like Iron Man, where there's actually color and there are jokes.
You can see what's happening and you can hear what's happening.
Yeah. Yes.
These shouldn't be optional.
All right. I want to move on to to your top three. We talked about a little bit about this earlier. I know this is coming along, but for people new to the pod who haven't had a chance to go back to listen to Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or The 13th Warrior, or Kingdom of Heaven, those are the other three pods that you guys have been on, and this is our first time. What are your top three medieval films?
I think we're agreed that this is the first.
Oh, it's got to be, right. It's the best.
Yeah, and I suspect that's true for all of us. I know for Thomas and me, it is. So, and I think we talked about this when we did The 13th Warrior, but my top three medieval movies are this. This is the first one. And then The 13th Warrior is probably number two. And number three is The Name of the Rose, which is like a Sean Connery murder mystery in in a library. Like, I love libraries.
We did that on the Sunday night thing, and people really surprised at how much they enjoyed it. Yeah.
I mean, mine are easy because we've now done all three of mine, and I guess I can put the Middle Ages to rest when I offer for HATM. It is Knight's Tale, and then, you know, no competition, but quite far down from there, 13th Warrior, which I love. And then Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I've achieved my goals here with medieval movies. Very happy.
It's time to become an Americanist, man.
I'm here. I'm ready. We're going to do La La Land next.
Thomas's schedule for La La Land is called Thomas and Jason Work Shit Out. So
that's just therapy. We won't be recording that. There will be much
later. And that is actually going to be a live one where he and I watch and we're like, oh, they're dancing. Oh, the colors. It's yellow. Oh, it's pretty. Oh, jazz. Oh, God, they don't end up together. God, the last 10 minutes of that movie, I've never wanted to throw a television through a wall so much of my life.
Really? It's the perfect
one. Oh, I hate it. All right. Anna, what do you got?
Knight's Tale. I'm not going to put 13th Warrior on the list. The translation scene was first, if it were all like that, but it's not. I love the translation scene. I love the scene with the mead where, oh, from bees. Okay.
It's honey!
Sorry, it gets too freaking weird. And I know that's the book's fault, but still. No one's mentioned Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Oh my God.
We still have not done that on this podcast.
Kathleen Kennedy's Coconuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it has an actual medievalist helping to write it. So I'm going to guilt trip you all on that one. And I'm going to leave my third spot blank because I have yet to see A Lion in Winter.
No, that's...
And I'm guessing that's going
It's on. Very good. It's very good.
Very good. I actually feel like, well done. I feel great amounts of shame now for not having mentioned Monty Python. Yeah, I have failed as a human.
I'm guilt tripping you.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, and you're going to be able to hold this over me forever. This shame is never.
She will, away. By the way.
No. And here's the thing. Every time I'm going to hang my head down, and somewhere in the distance, Charlie Brown music will play. You know, give me 5 more years, I will have that level of baldness. It's fine.
Monty Python is one of the few films we've done twice on HATM on Sunday nights. There's
so
that
good.
National it Treasure. Really I can't remember what else we've done, but Black Panther we've done twice, once after Chadwick Boseman passed. And I think there's one other film hanging around out there that we've done. All right, new scholarship. Give me one book in the Middle Ages, something you haven't given me before that you like.
So I'm going to point not to a book per se, but to Monica Green's more recent work on the origins of the Black Death. Sort of looking at DNA analysis of trying to figure out where it's coming from and sort of tracing its origins sort of back into the Central Asian steppes and sort of thinking about it as 4 distinct strands of plague that we know now rather than one. And thinking about pushing us to think about there's a narrative that the Black Death is primarily European because it doesn't show up in other archives, but like, are we actually thinking about other archives in the right way? Like her work sort of pushes in both of those directions at once, and it's really super useful. So that was sort of where I would go, is Monica Green's work on the plague.
Anna, what you got for us?
I'm going to add that Monica Green is the grand doyen of Black Death studies and
does
both the STEM and the history side beautifully. I was actually going to say Carissa Harris, go for her public writing. She has worked on Chaucer and obscenity, but she has also done a lot of work on consent. And there are all sorts of ways that medievalisms have been cropping up lately, especially in American politics. And Carissa Harris has a fair collection now of publicly available essays that help explain where we're getting certain ideas from. Ideas about, like, wenches and sexual availability and who can say no and who can't. So look for her work.
So when you say medieval, how broadly can I interpret that, Jason?
Man, I do fucking American history, dude. I don't give a shit.
Oh,
can
we bring this full circle back to what Anna was commenting? And I'd say the book I'd like to recommend is Sarah Bair's Land of Water, City of the Dead, Religion,
Ooh.
And Cahokia's Emergence from the University of Alabama Press, which is, in my opinion, the single best book on Cahokia, the coolest fucking medieval site I have ever been to. It's just outside of St. Louis. They are currently redoing the Museum Visitor Center, and I will be driving my kids down there the day that reopens in the most suburban dad way I possibly fucking can. Medieval is a term that we probably shouldn't apply to the Americas, but I don't get paid enough to come up with better terms. And pre-Columbian is also white supremacist bullshit. And pre-colonial is also white supremacist bullshit. And as long as, you know, we deal with the fact that medieval is also white supremacist bullshit when you apply it to the Americas, I'm going to go with it. Hoke is fucking great. That book is amazing. And you should just read it because, like, rethinking about the world and archaeology and religion and material culture, and it's also like $30 in physical form. You should get this book.
I was thinking about this or things like this sort of in preparation for this podcast, because in the last couple of weeks, you
prepared for this podcast?
Very slightly, a little bit. While I was pouring the bourbon. No, but in the last couple of weeks, you've had people talking about the U.S. West, right? And the question you have posed to them is, like, what is the U.S. West? How do we identify it? How do we think about where are the confines of it? And that's a question that is worth asking about the medieval, right? Like, where and what is the medieval, and how are we thinking about it, and what does it mean?
Thomas, John Wyatt warned you that I will hold stuff over your head forever. John Wyatt, tell me.
Yeah.
When do the Middle Ages end?
Did they? It may be worth at this point telling people that Anna and I were in grad school together. Anna's the other half of my cohort, or I am the other half of hers, however you want to phrase it. So we've been doing this for a while.
I'm going to be so alone.
But yeah, when does the Middle Ages end? That's such an interesting question.
Are you for the 19-somethings?
Yeah, I think you probably could. I don't know. I mean, my dissertation runs up to 1938. So, you know, why not? But part of that is because part of that has to do with medievalism. So the way that people are thinking about the medieval past and reinterpreting it in the 19th century, especially in the early 20th century. In my case, part of it is like this weird little bit of eel history that starts in the 15th century and stays in London, these eel ships, until like 1938. Like, there's a bit of the medieval past that continues existing as it was in the 15th century, you know, up to World War II. So it's difficult to draw hard and firm lines as much as people want to. And, you know, Thomas here is pointing out, like, are we thinking about medieval as a time period, as a geographic space, as what? Like, are we thinking, when we're thinking about North America in the 13th and 14th centuries, is that medieval? When we're thinking about Oceania in the 15th century, is that medieval? Or China, or are these, like, are we using the term sort of incorrectly because it's what we got and we're thinking about it like just, oh, it's the time period, so it must be medieval. And that, you know, that, that's ignoring all of the meanings that we freight on to the word and the term medieval, right? All of the negativity and all the rest of it.
Polynesia is definitely medieval in the 15th and 16th century. I go with Maddie Williams' book on this, Polynesia 900 to 1600, which is also
it's a great book.
A great book.
I didn't expect Moana to come into this, but okay. All right, let me ask you final question. You guys know this is coming. Is A Knight's Tale a history movie?
It's a sports movie. It even has the training montage.
And consequently, yes, sports are also history.
that's a slippery way out of that.
I'm going to pay for that answer. So at some point,
you guys
I'm
like, dodge. And I'm I dodge the fit, question.
Yeah. And it's going to be Anna. I'm not even going to have to turn around. It's going to be Anna, and I'm going to deserve it. And that's fine.
I realize that the podcast can't capture this, but I am making a series of faces here because what the heck?
I would say that it is a history movie. As much as people are going to listen to this and yell at me about that because of all of the anachronisms, and they are manifold and intentional, right? But it is, as I said earlier, like it is set in a very historical space. Its plot is actually driven by a lot of sort of real historical things, and if it is a historical fiction, sort of layered on top of that. I would say it's a historical movie. I wouldn't, you know, use it to teach about the medieval past in terms of like this happened and this happened and this happened, but like in terms of like teaching about like what the medieval past feels like. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and it'd be better at the beginning of the semester to be like, hey, you have bad ideas about what the Middle Ages were. Mm-hmm. And you have bad ideas about what the Middle Ages were for pop culture that are historical artifacts of the 21st century, not the Middle Ages. So let's do something from the 21st century before American film decides to go full grimdark.
Yeah.
Let's have, so it's both, it's a great history movie for where we are in summer 2001. It's also a great movie if you want to like be like, hey, the Middle Ages is a real period filled with actual people. And even if the sources we have do the things that like historical sources always do and turn them into caricatures of themselves, they're actual humans with real personalities and loves and hates and like desires and sports and fashion and food. And, you know, yeah.
Anna, final thoughts?
Oh, I'm just going to make you all feel old. I was 12 when it came out.
It's not the years.
Anna. No, I got to be honest. This is fantastic. I am usually the young person in the room. With these two.
It's almost always the old one.
It's true. I have the hair to prove it too.
You know what? We got to go find David Perry, Matthew Gabriel. They're
older.
They're beyond us in age. So we'll bring them back up when we do the Robin Hood bracket for March Madness, and so forth. All right, guys.
Thank you.
This has been fun. I've been looking forward to this podcast quite literally for months. We've been watching, waiting to do this one. We wanted to give us some space and some time, and I'm so glad we could do this. So thank you guys so very much. And I think all I have to tell you is good night.
I'll laugh. Thank you guys.
We like you anyway, Jason.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our motley crew of guests, Thomas Lecoq, John Wyatt Greenlee, and Anna Waymack. Guys, thank you so very much for being here, for being part of this journey that we've just had over the last hour and a half. I just love having you guys here with me, and I can't wait for our next film. Thank you, of course, to Fletcher Powell, our intrepid producer, for making this podcast happen. And thank you most of all to you guys in the stands. Maybe you're the kings and queens of the situation. I don't know. But guys, thank you so very much for being here every single week, for continuing to share this pod, for leaving comments, hopefully good ones, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. We've got a whole lot of stuff coming for you very shortly. We've got a brand new website that's going to be coming your way. We're going to have a TikTok channel. We've got YouTube coming. We have so much coming for you very shortly. So I hope that you are as excited as I am about which way HATM is going, and it's only growing because of you. So thank you so much. And if you're around Sunday night, we're going to be watching Aaron Brockovich. That's going to be on Netflix at 8 p.m. Eastern. So come along and live tweet that with us as well. So until then, ciao for now. Bye.